This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. Today we're focusing this program on one thing, PG&E's recent guilty plea to involuntary manslaughter for the deaths of 84 people in the 2018 campfire. If you have questions for us, let us know on our message line 433-9216 or go to our website, mynspr.org. For Wednesday, June 17th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. First, some news.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. California's death toll from the COVID-19 outbreak has exceeded 5,100, and the number of cases reached 153,560 Tuesday, an increase of more than 2,100 compared to Monday. The virus has claimed the lives of 424 Californians over the past 7 days. Fatalities statewide since the outbreak began total 5,121. Deaths are increasing at a weekly rate of 9%. The number of cases is rising by 15% a week as of Tuesday. Additional confirmed infections in the North State have pushed the 11-county region's caseload to 368 at last count. New infections were confirmed in Butte and Siskiyou counties. A recent bump in cases in Tehama County, the county jumped from 5 cases on the 1st of June to 28 at last count, prompted officials to issue a press release Tuesday attempting to allay concerns. Officials said they expected the caseload to climb as testing became more available. The release from the Health Services Agency said several recent cases were exposed prior to the loosening of restrictions and that close contact with someone already infected caused multiple new infections. As of Wednesday afternoon, Butte County was reporting 90 cases, Sutter County 89, Shasta County 51, Yuba County 37, Glenn County 34, Tehama County 28, Siskiyou County 20, Colusa County 7, Lassen and Plumas Counties 5 each, and Trinity County 2. At least 9 North State residents are currently hospitalized with COVID-19. 10 people in the region have died from it. Struggling businesses may see some temporary savings on workers' compensation insurance following an order issued Wednesday by State Insurance Commissioner Ricardo Lara. The regulations allow employers to reclassify workers doing their jobs from home as clerical, reducing workers' compensation insurance premiums. The order requires insurers to recalculate those premiums. The order is retroactive to March 19th, when Governor Gavin Newsom's statewide stay-at-home order went into effect, and will remain in place until 60 days after that order is lifted. A few nail salon operators, along with state and local elected officials, have scheduled a virtual press conference Thursday to discuss protocols for safely reopening manicure and pedicure shops. Local health authorities in some counties can begin allowing such businesses to reopen as soon as Friday. In other news, a brush fire erupted in the Thermalito area of Oroville shortly before noon on Wednesday. Mandatory evacuation orders were issued. CAL FIRE units, backed by a Forest Service helicopter, and the Oroville Fire Department responded. At least 4 homes were consumed. A red flag fire warning indicating high fire risk remains in effect for the valley and adjacent foothills through 1 p.m. Thursday due to brisk, dry winds. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. California's biggest utility company, Pacific Gas and Electric, pleaded guilty Tuesday to involuntary manslaughter for the deaths of 84 people in the 2018 campfire. The company will be fined millions of dollars, but no executives or employees are expected to face any prison time. The campfire resulted in some $16.5 billion in property damage and left PG&E defamed and bankrupt. Today, CAP Radio's host of Insight, Beth Ruyak, is going to take a closer look at the guilty plea and what's next. But first, we'll hear how one former Paradise resident is adjusting after his home was destroyed in the fire more than a year and a half ago. Casey Gibbs is a former substitute teacher and Air Force veteran. The first thing Beth asked him was how closely he's been following the court proceedings happening this week.
Well, I of course, immediately read the guilty plea. I think it's strange for me, as it is for everyone else, to see somebody confess to 84 counts of killing people, really. I think for anybody, that's incredible news. And I think it speaks to a lot of what I'd like to see happening, and that is that people are reconsidering this idea of deregulation is so great and is a great idea, when regulation is really what protects, you know, the vulnerable. And so, you know, for me, I hope that people think about that more.
Where were you on November 8th, 2018? Will you tell me a little bit of your experience that day and then what happened afterward?
As a matter of fact, that day I was about to accept a job offer down at Paradise Elementary, which everyone knows burned to the ground. And I'd gone outside because the winds had been so high that I actually wasn't really thinking about fires. I was thinking about, I just raked and cleaned everything. So I went outside, I opened the garage door, and when I looked out, I saw smoke, very heavy smoke, that seemed not 50 feet over the roof of the house. It seemed very close. And so I immediately, I was still in my pajamas, and I immediately just grabbed my sprinkler and a ladder and threw my sprinkler on the roof, and then went downstairs to see if I could hear anything on the scanner, to see if I could find out, you know, if there was a fire close by and whether we needed to be worried. And when I listened, they all said, hey, it's down in Holgate, 20 miles away. And I thought, that is bizarre, because it looks like it's right here. And about that time, my neighbor across the street, we were a close-knit community, so he saw me on the roof, and he ran across. He said, hey, I'm listening on mine, and it looks like there's two ignition points. So there's a fire close by. You might want to start getting your stuff packed and get ready to get out of here. At that point, I said, yeah, let's do that. I grabbed my wife and said, hey, pack up Allie's stuff. So she started packing all my daughter, who was two's, clothes. And I jumped into the shower. I hadn't showered yet. And I was getting out of the shower when a neighbor from down the street pulled up, and said, hey, the street's on fire. You need to evacuate now. So I quickly grabbed some clothes, and we jumped in the car. My neighbors on both sides, we all knew each other. And he said, hey, as I was getting out, he said, hey, I'm going to just make sure that these folks are getting out and are okay. Go ahead and get your family out of here. So we knew we couldn't go back down. At that point, we knew we couldn't go down what was Skyway, because it was completely blocked.
Right.
So we tried to take back roads, and it still took us 4 hours. We ended up going what is basically north towards Lake Amador and through some backwoods. But I will say that we never saw flames. Of course, my daughter was scared, because it was a scary time. I mean, there was certainly smoke in the air, and there was people that were, you know, had seemed to have lost all their mind. And in that area up above Magalia, there was no law enforcement or any kind of regulatory presence. So people were driving the wrong side of the road to get out on a very windy road. People had, and really the 4 hours took that long, because people had blocked the road entirely to get gas at the gas stations. Which seems bizarre to me now, or, you know, seemed bizarre to me then. I had no idea why the roads were so congested, but it was people trying to get gas.
Hmm. Casey, what do you think your family lost that day, and what do you feel like you personally lost in this tragedy?
I think my daughter carries around her backpack. When we go to grocery stores, she takes her toys with her. She's so afraid that her house is going to burn again that she takes everything with her. Everywhere she tries to take all of her toys with her. So I think that sort of peace and that we try to, that, that and the routine that we try to maintain was definitely affected. And it's very hard it's been hard to get her to overcome that, to say, okay, you can take in one toy. I can't tell you how many backpacks she's broken because she tries to pack them so full of all of her toys. And to me, it all goes back to that day of her trying frantically to grab all of her stuff and knowing that, you know, there's a probability that she's never going to see any of her things again. For us, both my wife and I have lost parents and grandparents, and we had a lot of heirlooms and things that we can't replace. And so those things are tangible, and there just isn't. You can't financially put a cost on those things. Those are things that are just lost, but they're just things. To me, what's more telling or more heartbreaking is really the loss of community, the loss of being able to go to the grocery store and hand, you know, your friends, because they all work there, your daughter while you shop because they want to play with her. There's a whole loss there that I think that people don't realize, because it was a small community.
And what about your house? What happened to your home?
Our home was completely destroyed. There was nothing left. You know, we had hopes that we could go up and, you know, maybe find coin collections and things like that that were heirlooms. But even that, everything to the windows was melted. There was literally nothing that survived.
I think those moments and some of the images that you're describing, your daughter and her backpack, those are the places where every one of us can connect with the pain through whatever frame of experience we have in our lives, though nothing, as you said, can compare to that actual experience. And yet some people stayed. Casey, some went back in when it was safe and they have begun to rebuild. Is this something you and your wife considered?
We did consider it. But it's you know, we've gone up because we've gone up to the property. We've kept the property because we hoped. We really hoped. And we still have one neighbor that whose house somehow miraculously, our next door neighbor's home was fine. It didn't burn. So we still had them there. But, you know, it's not the same. There's not the jobs, that the schools have burned. And there's, you know, the stores aren't the same. The people that work there, the people that you knew, it's hard. It's hard to think, I'm going to walk down this pathway that I used to wave and talk and chat with the old widow that was very sweet and kind. But I feel guilty because I didn't know that nobody told her. Nobody told her there was a fire coming. And she was lost. And so you live with sort of, I don't want to say guilt, but sort of a wish that you could go back and make sure that everybody got out, that things happened the right way, you know, that things happened better. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'll say that I think that losing your house and your belongings is a far cry from losing people that you love. So when I see things like when I see that 84 people that I was more that we were so much more lucky than 84 of my fellow neighbors, you know, how do you feel anything but grateful?
Casey, you're living now in Yuba City, and we're also in the midst of a pandemic. Schools have been closed. What is your job situation? And has this been, in some ways, one crisis on top of another for your family?
It absolutely has. I can't even describe to you how frustrating the timing seems to be. We felt like my daughter, who's now four and was in preschool and was really, you know, sort of a social butterfly. She loves it. And to say, okay, well, you know, there's no more gymnastics, there's no more ballet, there's no more this, you're stuck in your house. And those were things that we were using to sort of get her over the loss of her home. So on that end, as a parent, I will say, as a parent, it was very difficult. As far as jobs go, well, yeah, I was trying to make connections because I was graduating this year as a school psychologist. So part of being a substitute teacher was, hey, I'm going to make connections with the right folks. I'm going to get all my job lined up with, you know, some of the school districts. But you know, the pandemic happened, right? And so now even subbing is no more. So as far as work wise, it compounded the problem. So it made it worse. But you know, we're getting by and we're happy and everything's okay. I don't think that I wish that no one had to go through this.
That was Casey Gibbs. He's a substitute teacher who lived in the Magalia and Paradise area and is now living in Yuba City. You're listening to special coverage from North State Public Radio. When we return, we'll hear more from Beth about PG&E's guilty plea to involuntary manslaughter for the 2018 campfire. Stay tuned. This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Today we're focusing on the guilty plea of California's biggest utility, Pacific Gas and Electric Company, with CAP Radio's host of Insight, Beth Ruyak. PG&E Tuesday pleaded guilty to involuntary manslaughter of 84 people in the 2018 campfire.
We're going to play a little bit of the PG&E CEO Bill Johnson's testimony from yesterday's court hearing. Here it is as he said it.
I'm here today on behalf of the 23,000 men and women of PG&E to take responsibility for the fire that killed the people whose pictures we just saw as we went through the counts. And I've heard the pain and anguish of many of the victims as I've visited Paradise, as they've described the loss they continue to endure and the wounds that can never really heal. And no words from me can ever reduce the magnitude of that devastation or do anything to repair the damage. But I hope, and I sincerely hope, that the actions we're taking today will help bring some measure of peace. Our equipment started that fire, destroyed the towns of Paradise, Concow, severely burned Magalia, other parts of Butte County, took the lives of 85 people. Thousands of people lost their homes and businesses, forced to evacuate under horrific circumstances. I wish there was some way to take back, what happened or to take away the impact, the pain that these people have suffered. But I know that can't be done.
Family members of victims watched on YouTube. The judge, Michael Deems, set aside time for families to make statements beginning today. On the phone now is Robert Weisberg. He is law professor at Stanford Law School and co-director of the Stanford Criminal Justice Center. Professor Weisberg, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Will you give me your reaction to how CEO Bill Johnson has been navigating PG&E's role in the fire leading up to yesterday and then particularly yesterday?
Well, he's probably made the best he can of a bad situation. And by the way, one he came into very late in the process. PG&E is now the most scrutinized corporation in America in some ways. And it is undergone every conceivable form of legal liability. And the criminal part of it, in some ways, turns out to be more symbolic than the rest. You can't put a corporation in prison. You can punish it if what it has done collectively constitutes a crime, and that seems to have been conceded here. But what does punishment mean? It almost always means taking lots of its money. In theory, that money being a fine could go to government, in this case, the state government or the county government. But of course, the main concern is that it go to victims. Now, of course, there were also civil suits, which any individual victim can bring, and that can result in damages. But in addition, not only is PG&E a heavily regulated company, but it's now in bankruptcy. So it has creditors who are taking assets from it or trying to take assets from it. And it's going through bankruptcy and it'll get reconstituted in some way. So another way to look at it is another form of punishment is losing control of its own operations and management by yielding them to court officials, whether it's bankruptcy officials or possibly even the sentencing judge in the criminal case. So it's all overdetermined. The assets of PG&E are going to be divided up, but chances are there will be something called PG&E that will continue if the company exits Chapter 11. The thing is, PG&E is technically a criminal, yes, that has pleaded guilty to a horrendous number of homicides, but it's also just an extremely abstract entity. And therefore, this case just underscores just the paradox of criminally punishing a so-called person, I'm putting that term in quotes, who is really a corporation. Hmm.
And no executives individually will be going to prison. Is this the first, though, for an American company to be charged with and then plead guilty to homicide?
It's happened in a few other cases. It's very, very rare. Certainly nothing like this number. There have certainly been prosecutions that haven't ended up in convictions. In fact, it goes back, 40 years or so to an infamous event involving a car called the Ford Pinto. This is one of the consumer scandals that made Ralph Nader famous. And the Ford Motor Company was actually criminally prosecuted in a state court in Indiana for involuntary manslaughter, pretty much the same charge that PG&E is facing here. That case ended in an acquittal. This is, again, certainly the largest. But again, one of the ironies here is that given all the civil suits, the earlier criminal case against PG&E, which was successful, that was a federal case, not brought under state homicide law, but under brought because of violation of federal regulations of pipeline safety rules. And those violations were deemed criminal and led to huge fines. And if you add the bankruptcy, by the time we get to this guilty plea, there isn't much left of PG&E in a way. There's just something kind of ironic about characterizing it as, you know, the perpetrator of 84 homicides. It sounds very lurid. It sounds like it's a mass murder. It's not a murder. It's a manslaughter or almost a serial killing. But the fact is, it's just the last sort of sad legal, box to be checked in the virtual demise of PG&E as it had existed.
One last point I'd like you to respond to, Professor Weisberg, and that is that The CEO, Bill Johnson, had previously announced that he's going to retire on June 30th. And as you said, he came in somewhat late to all of this, but he's been the public face and the public voice of the apology, the taking of responsibility, the visiting paradise, talking with the families. And we are in such a highly charged time in our country where an apology, a sense of responsibility, an effort at retribution, an expression of remorse are some of the most important actions that we can lift up right now. So in terms of the law and moving forward, how weighty is the way that Bill Johnson, on behalf of PG&E, has been conducting this?
Compared to what you might expect and sometimes see of corporate executives, I think he's, you know, I think he's been impressive and effective. Because even when there is an apology from a corporation, it's often highly rhetorical, highly cliched, and highly artificial. It just goes to the question of the now leadership of PG&E. Nobody who takes this job is going to say, yes, well, PG&E has been defamed, and, you know, I'm going to stand for the values of PG&E. Another way to look at it is, it, in theory, would lie within the power of the court, certainly the federal court, to put PG&E into a receivership. That happens with companies sometimes. It happens with public agencies. You may be aware that the entire healthcare system of the California prison system is actually under federal court receivership. Here, whoever becomes the private sector CEO of PG&E after Mr. Johnson is in effect, not in law, but in effect, a kind of court-ordered receiver, because whoever takes it over is going to take it in a situation where the new CEO would acknowledge, okay, we did terrible things, we're trying to start all over, we're trying to do the right thing. So in that sense, I think it's about effective an expression for Mr. Johnson as he could possibly get. But I also want to emphasize that this is a really unusual situation, because PG&E, it was A, a regulated company in the most, one of the most regulated of industries, and B, it's being picked apart for lots of other reasons anyway. So whether this signals some kind of new attitude that we might see from corporations for corporate malfeasance in other contexts, too soon to tell.
That was Robert Weisberg, co-director of the Stanford Criminal Justice Center, speaking with CAP Radio's host of Insight, Beth Ruyak. And that is your program. As always, if you have thoughts for us, leave them on our message line, 433-9216, or go to our website, mynspr.org. Today's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, Angel Haracha, Eric Radaville, Kylo Castilla, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. A special thanks to CAP Radio. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, news director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30, or catch the rebroadcast the following morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned to North State Public Radio.